and welcome. It's Books of the Year here, the podcast from your friends at Books of the Year. I think that's all we need to say by way of introduction.
You should know by now. I mean, you've already downloaded it, so you know.
A couple of emails before we proceed. Peter Gedge has been in touch. Many thanks for all your guidance over the years on books, which has resulted in me reading good ones, giving good presents, and knowing what I should avoid. As part of my retirement resolutions, I have agreed with myself to read more, but also to use our local library more frequently.
Good idea.
I now have an online account and have ordered 3 books. Their titles are
Oh my goodness,
TikTok,
mate.
Knife Edge, and Black Tag.
Imagine.
I mean, I don't
great choices there. I think we can all agree.
There are 3 itch books, and there's also Blame and Mad Blood Stone.
Yeah.
The other resolutions are no consultancy, no freebies for industry bodies, and no gardening for the good doctor her indoors. 2 out of 3 ain't bad, but I do have permanently dirty fingernails. Okay, well, whatever. A surreal email from Peter. Oh, Peter, what can I say? But thank you very much, and carry on downloading my books.
Well, indeed. An email from Jessica who says, "Hi, lads. In response to your listener's question about songs inspired by books, here are my first thoughts. Killing an Arab by The Cure, inspired by Albert Camus' The Stranger. Sex Crime by The Eurythmics, inspired by George Orwell's 1984. Love the show, Steve. Love all the recommendations. Black Tag in paperback is on order at my independent local bookshop. Shout out to Station Books in Tunbridge Wells. And to all physical, you can walk in and talk to someone in an independent bookshop. Quite right too, Jessica. Well done.
That's very good.
Another blatant plug there for
Black Tag, which isn't out in paperback for a while, but thank you very much indeed, Jessica.
Yes.
I think the plan is, I probably shouldn't say any of this, but I think the plan
is... Do it anyway.
To put a chapter of my next book into the paperback.
Oh, great idea.
So that when Jessica does get the paperback of Black Tag, it'll have the the new one.
Yeah, no, love it.
You can email us anytime, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. We're on Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Pick Any Page. Now we speak to acclaimed best-selling author, a man who wears a hat indoors.
Indeed.
Francis Bufford. So, Francis Bufford, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's very, and you've never been on before.
I haven't, no. I'm a first-timer.
But that's kind of your fault, in as much as you were writing non-fiction for a long time, weren't you?
I was, but, you know, non-fiction can be fun too. Even though I'm now a confirmed, converted novelist, I suppose, I still have a brief for non-fiction. I won't hear a word against it, but it's okay if you prefer fiction.
Yeah, it's not going to get a look in for a while, and that is the that is the honest truth. The new book is called None Such. One word. Matt, describe the cover, please.
Yes, so it was a very classy cover. So it's purple and gold. Those are going to be the predominant colours shouting out to you from your bookshop when you see this on the shelves. And your eye is first going to be drawn to these spirals. I'm going to say the spirals of lightning. There may well be something else, but gold and purple spirals of lightning. And in the background, you can see St. Paul's, and St. Paul's surrounded by smoke, which will straight away remind you of that that famous picture of St. Paul's during the Blitz when it stood there untouched, but there were all these balloons of smoke around it. And then there's a small woman, a small figure near St. Paul's, and she's surrounded by, well, she could be surrounded by a force field, perhaps, around the Blitz. Of these gold spirals, and then None Such, written in big gold bold letters at the top, and just beneath the title are 3 bombers, and then right at the bottom, Francis Bufford.
I just think those kind of the swirly gold could be a tail. Do you think?
I think it's supposed to be a kind of magical portal.
Portal.
That was what they were going for, a sort of time tunnel, timey-wimey, kind of spiralling inwards on change and mystery and enchantment was the idea, I think.
Did they send you a bunch of ideas?
No, they just came up with that one, and I went, I like that. So
good.
Okay, all right.
But yeah, authors don't get trusted a great deal to decide what the cover is, it has to be said.
So Matt's mentioned the Blitz. He's also mentioned swirly-swirly portally things, so which is kind of getting to the heart of where we're introduced us to None Such. It's the outbreak of the Second World War, we're in London. Over to you, Francis. Introduce us to this tome of yours.
It's, well, it's a historical fantasy, which I think means that it has to be a historical novel that works properly and a fantasy novel that works properly. And it's about a chancer, this young woman from North London who is rising without trace and trying her best to invent herself in the world of money and the city just before the Second World War begins, which is difficult because it is a very, very male-dominated place where none of the rules let a woman do anything, really. But Iris Hawkins is a person of resource who is not used to letting things that are stronger than her bully her. She's actually quite ruthless and quite manipulative. And the book begins on the night of a date that goes horribly wrong. When the bloke she's seeing, who comes from a long line of kind of handsome idiots, which is what she prefers in the way of male company because they don't get too close, turns out to be such an idiot that he's completely misunderstood the occasion he's taking her to, which he thinks is a sort of cigars and chorus girls kind of deal, but actually he's led her off to meet some intellectuals who are going to look at the pair of them and make judgments, which Iris hates. And the evening leaves the rails it was going to be on and goes somewhere completely different. She finds herself dancing in a nightclub full of strangely dressed intellectuals and bumping into a party from the BBC, the people who make the very, very, very early television that's coming out of Alexandra Palace, among whom are a annoyingly, maddeningly, perfectly good-looking little blonde woman who turns out to be a British fascist, and the boy who's stuck on her, who partly, you know, as much to annoy the fascist as anything else, Iris nabs and takes home for a one-night stand that evening, but it turns out that this sets going a whole complicated, ever-darkening story about statues with spirits caught inside them and a very unpleasant occult society which the blonde fascist woman is involved with, and an attempt to manipulate the course of the war by engaging in a kind of magical time travelling. So as, tell me when this is too much, I'm trying to avoid spoilers here, yeah. but
this is literally like the first 20 pages.
So, yeah.
So you haven't spoiled.
No. Okay, but I'm trying to be evocative and suggest that from a beginning like that, it rolls onwards, getting more magical, more historically authentic, and contains more of Iris behaving fairly badly, and. Oh, no, I can't say any more. Can I?
Okay, so the Blitz is a grim old time. Mm. Where did the idea for making it grimmer come from? So we everyone is familiar with stories of the Blitz and the bombs falling and buildings being turned to rubble. But in a way, we know and understand that horror, and you've introduced a whole new horror. Were you just walking the streets of London and thought, how can I make this more grim for everybody?
I am mean and unpleasant like that, yes. Yeah. But and I do, in fact, walk the streets of London with contemporary maps because that seems to be how my imagination gets going when I'm storytelling my way into the past. But no, it's because of exactly what you said, that we all feel we know the story of the Blitz already. We understand its grimness, and I wanted to do something which gave it a kind of half twist, a magical half twist, and that got us to see it freshly again and reminded us that it wasn't just a grim old time, it was an astonishingly strange time as well, with a city of several million people reduced to kind of total blackness at night, with random death falling out of the sky, with total uncertainty about where the world was going, a sense that an enormous tide of evil was coming inexorably in London's direction. And I thought, actually, come up with a magical half twist on this, and you can see what's really there as well. Fantasy strikes me as a good way of reminding us what the world is actually like, as well as adding horrors to it.
So we're going to get to the magic in a second. We'll get to the fantasy in a second. But I want us to stay on the Blitz, on London. So what struck me as I was reading this is, as Simon said, we all think we know what it was like being in London during the Blitz, with, as you say, death coming from above and the blackouts. What struck me was how I think your book made me feel the first of how it must have felt to be in London during a blackout. Now, this is going to sound the most obvious thing, that everything is totally, totally black. The complete lack of any light, meaning walking down a street contains horrors. The absolute nightmare of being able to just do very banal things. So I just want you to talk a little bit about that before we get to the fantasy. Just talk about how you were sort of evoking this world where everything is black. There is, and it seems the most obvious thing in the world, but really there are horrors there even before we get to the magic.
The first thing that happened after the blackout, long before German bombs started falling, is that the rate of accidents skyrocketed in London because, exactly as you've said, nobody could see where they were going. Cars mounted pavements with their kind of headlights reduced to a tiny dot or thread of light. People got run over by buses. People walked into each other all the time. And, of course, it was a license for kind of various kinds of predatory behaviour as well. Because if you're out to mug somebody or rape somebody or nick things, then the darkness was lovely. It was a kind of cloak of night for various ordinary kinds of horror to go on in. But there was a kind of so. All right, I'm trying not to talk about magic yet, but it had a kind of transforming effect on what city life was like, but people adapted to it. That's the thing that in a way is hardest for us to get our heads around, I think, hardest for me anyway, that it became rapidly, no, normal is pushing it, but something people were resigned to and adapted to. And when the bombs did start falling for tens of nights in a row, so nobody in London was getting unbroken sleep for something like 65 nights, and contemporary accounts, they're all walking around like zombies at kind of half speed as a result, unless a siren goes, and then kind of prestissimo, they're kind of bouncing along at double time towards the nearest shelter. When we think of a kind of emergency like that, I think our natural tendency is to go some terrible one-off. You know, a plane crashes, people behave heroically or not, they emerge with PTSD, they go in for months of therapy, it takes years to get over it. But in this case, it just keeps happening. So you spend the night hiding in the cupboard under the stairs or in the basement of the co-op or in some dreadful urine-smelling public shelter somewhere out in the East End. The bombs happen not to fall on you. Dawn comes, so you put your good coat on, which you haven't been able to wash but which looks okay, and you go to work. You discover which of the buses are still running, and if your bus isn't going, you take a different one. Some of the tube lines will be out, but not all of them. You get to the office more or less on time, stepping over broken glass as you go, and then you do a day's work. And then at 5 o'clock, particularly if it's going to autumn, so it's dark already, you weave your way incredibly carefully through the dangerous streets. You find out which buses are still going. You go home and you try to get some sleep before the sirens go. You eat something completely horrible, which a newspaper recipe has told you how to make with rationed food. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, you get woken up again. You go and hide under the stairs. You wait to see if you die that night. And then you do it again and again and again and again and again. And it's that kind of exhausted repetition that I thought this was the thing that astonished me and which I wanted to kind of bring through.
So Iris, as you mentioned, I'm loving spending time with. I think she's a terrific character. So she ends up in Hampstead with this BBC guy, Jeff. I'd never go anywhere near BBC technicians.
Don't do that.
They're always trouble. And then we get a creature. I mean, apart from a few teasy pages right at the very beginning, everything that we've just talked about is a normal story about the Blitz. Mm. Terrifying, horrific, but we kind of know the story. We know what the government is doing, and we know how long the war is going to last. Into that world of chaos, Iris looks out of the window, and she sees a thing. What is it that she sees?
She sees the outline of what looks like a man in a trench coat and a hat standing under a street lamp, except that this figure is moving unlike any human body, in that it is laying its head completely flat on one shoulder and then slowly swinging it over like a metronome and doing it on the other side. And when it moves as if there is liquid inside its clothes rather than something solid. At that point, Iris's one-night stand suddenly becomes a great deal more fear-filled than it already was. But what I'm hoping is that at that point, we reading it, me writing it, I've been put back into the state of total uncertainty about what's going to happen, which people who weren't coming across monsters in trench coats were feeling as the war began, that it's a magical way of doing the state of open-ended terror that people actually felt.
So what do we call this thing?
It is the Watcher with a capital W, and it comes with the house because Jeff, it turns out, as well as being a BBC technician, is also the irascible, put upon but very conscientious carer for his charming but totally hopeless father, who is a kind of librarian for an occult archive. The house is filled with magical junk of one kind and another, and the order, we never find out its full name, which set them up with the house and the magical junk, has left the Watcher outside on the pavement to keep an eye on it. But it turns out that by annoying the fascist blonde Lau back at the nightclub, Iris has put the Watcher on her own trail. So when she flees at dawn in the traditional stuff your knickers in your handbag moment, going, that was a bad idea and I'm going to try and forget that it ever happened, the Watcher follows on slow liquid feet, and she comes across it again in, of course, the blackout near her office, which is in the city somewhere down near London Bridge. And it then becomes a kind of tale of terror about pursuit, in which, much against her will, she has to involve herself again with Jeff because Jeff is an innocent and a nice guy, and he's therefore kind of flat contrary to the category of blokes she prefers to be involved with. She likes the handsome idiots. He is unworldly, naive. She accidentally kind of collected his virginity that night. And she doesn't want to see him ever again because he makes her feel strange, guilty, responsible. But she has no option in trying to deal with the thing that's chasing her. I have to be careful of spoilers here. There is a way out of this dilemma, but only at the cost of getting her more deeply involved with the bigger problem of what else the Order has up its sleeve and the danger of a magical kind that it poses to a city which is already in grave danger from the falling bombs.
So obviously we're conscious we don't want to do any spoilers here, but we need to be able to tell listeners what exactly they can expect from the book. So I do want us to talk, if you pick up this book in the bookshop and you, the first thing you do is you open up the inside cover, you will see a map of London, and there will be there are statues there, but they are bluntly, these are angels. Yep. Sprouting out from
spoilers that, yes, all right, this is, yes, very early in my career, yes, in talking about it, so I haven't quite worked out what
it's
it is.
It's in the map on page.
Yeah, I know. They've given it away anyway.
They
are.
Let's talk. I want you to talk a little about. So you've mentioned The Watcher.
Yeah.
I want you to talk a little bit about angels, because angels do feature in the book. And so we've already come across Jeff, who you've been very polite about. I'm going to call him Wet. He's a bit wet, is Jeff. Iris, I love spending time with Iris. Jeff, a little bit wet. But Jeff's
nothing
dad...
Nothing wrong with being a little bit wet.
Yes, nothing wrong with that. But Jeff's dad, Mr. Hale, tells us about angels. So this, and this is really important to me for someone who's not normally a reader of fantasy books, is that Mr. Hale was the, if we're going to use the word portal, he's the means by which I understand this world you've created.
Yeah.
So I want you to act as Mr. Hale here, okay, and tell us about angels. Tell us, to people who don't normally pick up these books, tell us what we can expect from angels in this book.
Right. The one thing that the mysterious order know how to do, in among all of their kind of necromantic rubbish, is that they know how to summon and bind and enslave angels. An ugly business, but it gives you magical servants of immense power. And the Watcher, in his rotting greatcoat and his hat and his alarming face made of moving newspaper, is in fact a captive angel who is obliged to do what he's bidden. And there are others out there. There are a set of statues located around the rooftops of the city of London, which have captive angels inside them. And these angels Jeff thinks that they're kind of electromagnetic phenomena, and I like the idea that the atmosphere, as well as being full of kind of signals of radio and early TV and bombers, also has these kind of intelligences made of radio waves floating around in them. But they are proper angels. They're not kind of pretty Victorian angels with coloured wings and party frocks. They are biblically authentic angels, which means that they are so strange that if you see them straight on, they kind of hurt your mind to look at them. They behave like kind of migraine inducing kind of rifts into higher dimensions. They're not evil, but they are helpless about doing what they're told when captivated by the order. So they are very dangerous. But because they're angels, they have a kind of continuing connection to the world beyond time. And centuries ago, some alchemists discovered that you could use this to force a group of them to give you a pathway to what they call, kind of code name, the Palace of Nonesuch, somewhere from which you could get to any point in time. And this network of captive angels has survived over the centuries, and now the kind of fascist magicians of the order have rediscovered it, and they've worked out that though it is immensely dangerous and requires kind of being up on the rooftops of London on nights of air raids and flying shrapnel, there would be a way to get to Nonesuch, the place outside time, and alter the course of the war by removing, for example, unhelpful Mr. Churchill, who doesn't want to make peace with Hitler.
I think it's page 112 when we first find the word
yes,
Nonesuch.
Yeah, yeah.
And listeners to this podcast and readers of the book will be going, okay, this is great. Nonesuch? What,
okay.
You know, what is this? So it's the title of the book, so... Why is it called that? And you need to explain why it's called that.
Okay. Once upon a time, there was a real place called the Palace of Nonesuch, which was like Hampton Court, apparently, only kind of even more wonderful, which in one of those kind of awkward twists of history got knocked down and sold for parts so that King Charles II could pay off one of his mistress's gambling debts.
I see.
I know. Good old Charles II. It was called Nonesuch because at the time that meant no other thing as good as this, kind of Nonesuch, no other ones like this.
Right.
But But the word, I love the word, it also can mean there are no things like this. So it seemed absolutely right for something which kind of trembles in between existing and not quite existing. So it's a kind of borderline word for a place which kind of flickers in and out of existence and is very hard to get to. But I also just really like the word. I am slightly word fixated, and I wanted this one on the cover. And the sequel, which that's a bit previous in getting to that, will also have an unusual word as its title, and it may annoy people, but I'm not sorry.
It does. It is a classic. It literally says on the last page, "to be continued," which we'll get to in just a moment. I just want, although Iris is the star, and in the movie adaptation, that's the part that everyone's going to go for. But I just want to sing the praises of Wet Jeff.
I do too. I love Jeff.
Because
I don't think he's that wet.
No. Techie Jeff, because I wonder if his scepticism is our way in to all of this, because a lot of people will be going, what is this codswallop that you're talking about? And he says at one stage, what if it's all nonsense?
Yeah.
And I think having a skeptic like that is really useful, because it sort of helps us navigate our way into your magical world.
I absolutely agree. Jeff is there to speak up for all of us as we go, what, as things unroll. And Jeff has had to endure many years of living with his father, who, as he points out, believes any old rubbish about kind of fairies, pyramids, ley lines.
I think he calls one room in the house a storehouse of occult bilge.
Yeah, exactly. And most of it is, but so yeah, Jeff's bracing skepticism is supposed to allow us to kind of vent our own feelings as things get stranger. But Jeff is also a proper scientist, and confronted with a phenomenon which is happening in front of his nose, he does not go kind of, my worldview prevents me from believing this. He goes, I wonder which radio waves it's using. So I'm hoping that if Jeff is convinced, we'll be convinced too. But I want to speak up for Jeff in other ways too. I've had very good take up for Jeff from two groups, straight women and gay men. And I think if they approve of Jeff, then possibly I have done him more or less right, and he is quite attractive. And he's a good guy.
Yeah, it's only Matt, I think.
It's only me, isn't it? I've got it wrong. Good for me. let's take us back to right at smack bang in reality, as we remember it, of the Blitz in 39 in London. And that is the fascists. You've already mentioned, so that there is a woman we meet very early on who reveals herself to be very much sympathetic to the fascists. And then we have another encounter with her in which it is made very, very clear that she is sympathetic to the fascists. And it struck me reading this that how brazen they were, given that the country was at war, literally at war with fascism, how brazen the British fascists were. And, I mean, there's an add-on to this that reading the book right now in February 2026... You cannot not think of other events going on in the world right now. But I'm going to, as attractive as that might be for me for us to talk about, I want us to root ourselves back in 39 and how brazen and blatant British fascists were at such a time when we were at war with it.
Oswald Mosley's fascists behaved as if they were the coming thing, as if their rise was completely inevitable. And they were running candidates in by-elections at the beginning of the war on a peace platform. They said, you know, we're the peace party. We think an understanding with Herr Hitler is perfectly possible for just, you know, the negligible price of kind of saying goodbye to democracy and freedom forever. One of the things that's also hard to understand now is just how much out in plain sight they were, and how much someone like Mosley had struck a whole raft of unlikely people in the 1930s as this kind of fresh, vigorous, exciting, action-oriented guy. They didn't yet have the kind of mental slideshow of concentration camps running behind their eyes. So fascists numbered unlikely supporters like ex-suffragettes who thought that he was modern, and people confused by the modern world in all sorts of ways, and anti-Semites and people who wanted to blame immigrants and foreigners. But I'm steering clear of contemporary residences. I will say that when I was writing the book, I would have been very happy for it to stay historical. I didn't want it to be topical. That was not my plan. No. Blame the world, not me. They were out in the open, and it was part of the strange half-heartedness with which Britain was conducting the war for the first 8-9 months until Chamberlain fell from power and Churchill took over, that they were just kind of left to get on with it, to kind of organise, to march about in the streets with their flags going, fascism means peace, fascism for king and empire, with kind of girls playing side drums and people in uniforms Hitler saluting and stuff. And it is very... It's weird to think of this city which is at war with fascism that contains fascists marching about. Once Churchill comes to power, suddenly they get regarded as a serious threat, and they all get kind of banged up and thrown into Holloway Jail. The difficulty in the story being that people compiling lists of dangerous fascists are just as sexist as anybody else in 1939 and 1940. So they leave out some of the women, including the one who is Iris's particular kind of enemy and problem. So from then on, what you've got is a kind of duel between two women. Because if I was going to have a woman as a hero, I wanted to have a woman as a villain as well. And one of the other things that's strange about the Blitz is that, as well as being a kind of time of terror and a time of enormous uncertainty and a time of suffering, it's also simultaneously a time of kind of weird, unexpected freedom for women, because almost all the men between 18 and 46 have suddenly disappeared. They've gone off and been conscripted. So the streets are suddenly more full of women than anybody else, and women are being called on to kind of run the world. And it's one of those things where society kind of turns on a sixpence. They go from going, women can't possibly do that, it's unladylike, to going, women have to do that, and if you need a creche and some childcare, we can sort that out for you by Monday. So this is Iris's chance to kind of rise in her job, but it also means that it's up to her to deal with an enemy who has also been kind of liberated by the strange times of the war.
So fascist lunatics, we're used to reading about, magical fascist lunatics, is not something that we're going to feel very comfortable with, and they do seem quite scary.
Good. I'm glad, because yes, you're supposed to be scared. I would have done it wrong had you gone, oh, magical fascist lunatics, oh, just them. But there is some historical kind of, you know, some historical footing for this. Fascists did tend to be interested in weird occult things. They were particularly the ones in Germany, but the ones in Britain too. There was a crossover between fascism and a whole load of unlikely things like organic vegetables. Fascist organic vegetables?
Wow.
Let's leave that on one side. But also black magic of various kinds. And I think the kind of Aleister Crowley world, though I think the key here is that fascism is a politics of bullying. It's a politics of being kind of pumped up with the powerful pleasure of forcing lesser beings to do your will. And a spell, if one actually worked, would be a way of bullying the universe and forcing it to do your bidding as well. So in a world in which there is some real magic, as there is in none such, then you would kind of expect fascists, who are lunatics, to also be magical fascist lunatics.
Yes. So To be continued, so there's another one. How big is this world? Are there three? Because
no,
everyone
it's,
likes
it's
three.
Strictly a two. This is where
you say that now.
No, I mean that now. I really do mean that. Mean that now. I knew from the beginning that this was a kind of, it had a two book arc to it, and I know where it stops, and I'm 2/3 of the way through writing the sequel, and honestly, it's gonna stop. Though I will be very sad not to spend any more time in being Iris and in Iris's company, because she's a great character to write.
Well, she's certainly a great character to read. I mentioned at the beginning that you used to write nonfiction, and then you've converted to the fictional cause. Is it true that you have somewhere on your laptop a C.S. Lewis Narnia book, which you didn't get approval for, and so therefore you can't publish it?
It is true, but part of not getting approval was that I got legally bound over not to talk about it in public. So
you haven't. So I've just asked you, and you've said I'm not talking about it.
Indeed. I'm not talking about this thing that does, in fact, exist on my laptop. Yeah.
2034, is that the year you can publish it?
I never looked it up myself, but yes, as a matter of fact, by total coincidence, that is the year that C.S. Lewis's copyright runs out.
70 years after his death.
Yes. This book, too, has a kind of C.S. Lewis connection to it. None such, I mean.
Nicely swerved.
Thank well you. Done. I'm moving away from the point of legal danger here. It's like a vast pothole and I'm not getting into it. This, too, has a kind of C.S. Lewis connection because I grew up as a lover of the Narnia books, and he's like a kind of... If there is a sort of Narnia-like lair in this, only Narnia for adults, I would be completely delighted because he shaped my imagination when I was growing up. And there is a famous problem in the Narnia books to do with whether Susan, one of the four original children, why she doesn't get to stay in Narnia at the end. And she's described as being too interested in lipstick and invitations nowadays. And lovers of C.S. Lewis and lovers of Narnia have been arguing about this for about 70 years and going, come on, he's not just being sexist, he's making a spiritual point of some kind. But no, he was also just exhibiting a kind of really annoying bachelor incomprehension about kind of why it's fun to be a girl. So I thought, if you were going to do something that was magical, which was heading back onto kind of Narnian territory a bit, you'd have a heroine who was really into lipstick and invitations. You begin by going, that stuff is part of the joy of being alive and is no bar to enchantment and wonder, which is why Iris is really into lipstick and invitations and all of the things about male company that those lead to.
Yes. Lipstick and invitations is a good name for another book somewhere down the line.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Maybe.
Right at the very beginning, the book, we read that the book is dedicated to Nancy Gwendolyn Spufford, 1911 to 2011, and then in italics, not entirely a good girl. Is there anything that you can tell us about?
Yeah, that's my granny, who died at 99 and a half, and who, till she was 96 or 7, was very kind of vigorous and out in the world and kind of interested in stuff. And early in her 90s and sort of towards the beginning of this century, I went and had lunch with her at a restaurant called Veera Swami's off Regent Street, which is like the oldest
Indian restaurant in Britain.
You know the one. And we sat down and she looked around and she went, I was last here in about 1935. Hasn't changed much. And then she said, with absolutely kind of no prompt from me, she said, I always used to prefer to go out with married men because they always spent so much more money on you. And then she clammed up. And so I got this like momentary sort of little window opened on what must have been a kind of quite kind of naughty good time she'd had in the early 30s. And she was not a storyteller. I don't know why she said that then. So in some ways, Iris, who also, I mean, my grandmother came from Watford. Iris comes from Watford. That's the only point of connection. Iris is invented, but Iris is my way of trying to imagine my way sympathetically and as in a spirit of celebration into the good time that my grandmother may have had.
Yes. So a little bit of the spirit of Nancy is in there.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. It's terrific fun. Loved it very much. Nonesuch is the new book from Francis Spufford. Francis, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.